Okay, we'll bring to order the meeting of the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee, and we'll start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Constantine.
Here.
Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Hertas.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero. Representative Neuberger.
Yes, sir.
Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Rosenthal. Representative Schoen. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Winkler. And Representative Zerwas.
Okay, members. If somebody wants to move the minutes of March 12th. Representative Ward moves the minutes of March 12th. With no objection, all approved say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, members, Representative Hillstrom, I just kind of give you a heads up. We're going to have a bunch of bills in before deadline, and so I'm going to try to get my group here not to talk them to death or love them to death and try to get through. We've got the meeting rooms reserved for each evening if we need them, but we'd sure like to get through the bills during the day if we can. And I don't think there's anything real controversial coming up. But so we'll start off with, what do we got? House File 1354 and House File 1286. These two gentlemen, representatives Hackbarth and Grunhagen, are going to appear together because of the same ventured bills. And go ahead, sir, whichever you'd like to begin.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe somebody would like to move the bill.
Right.
Representative Hillstrom is a co-author of the bill.
I'll move the bill.
Representative Hillstrom moves House File. We had a number of volunteers, Representative Howe and Representative Johnson, so must be a good bill. House File 1354, recommended to pass and move to local government ops, government operations. Okay, the bill's moved. Go ahead, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is a bill that has two different portions to it. It has to do with reporting of firefighter deaths and a health insurance issue. And with me today, I have a few. We're going to try to be as brief as we can. So I'm going to get right into the testimony. And if we have a couple of fire chiefs here that would like to explain the bill.
Okay, and then Representative Grunig, you jump in whenever you want here during the process.
Yeah, I'll just make a quick comment, Mr. Chair. I know there's a lot of bills pending here. You know, I'm a strong supporter of this. I think you'll hear good, strong testimony as to the necessity of this. But this is my first unfunded mandate, so I have a lot of anxiety inside about putting it. But I will support these bills. Okay.
All right. Great. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And go ahead, sir. Begin your name and title and begin.
George Esmondson, Fire Chief for the City of Eden Prairie. I'm also the Legislative Chair for the State Fire Chiefs Association. And I want to start by thanking Representative Hackbarth and Grunhagen and also Representative Hillstrom for their support in authoring this bill and bringing this bill forward today. As Representative Hackbarth stated, there are really two components to the bill. The first one is reporting any active firefighter death to the State Fire Marshal's Office so that they can determine whether it was, in fact, a line-of-duty death. And this has a little bit of history to it, and I won't bore you with all the details, but just to say that in a previous fundraising effort to build the Fallen Firefighter Memorial at the Capitol, when we were out doing our fundraising, we found instances of, historically, of firefighters who apparently were killed in the line of duty, but because the local jurisdiction didn't understand about benefits and so on for those people, they were never reported as such. And so this part of the bill, like the second part, has broad support from the Minnesota Fire Service. Secondly, and is also supported by the State Fire Marshal's Office. Secondly is the volunteer firefighters killed in the line of duty and having their survivor families have health insurance provided to them. So currently in the state of Minnesota, there's a fund that seeks to defray the cost of local jurisdictions who provide this benefit. So if a career firefighter is killed in the line, dies in the line of duty, their survivor family is entitled to ongoing health care benefits until that firefighter would have reached age 65. But specifically in state statute, carves out non-career, volunteer, paid-on-call firefighters. And as you know, of the state's 20,000 firefighters. About 18,000 are non-career or part-time or paid-on-call firefighters, covering all different sizes and manners of cities. And we believe that this inequity needs to be corrected. Our municipalities are already getting a great value out of our non-career firefighters. A recent Humphrey Institute report estimates that our system that we use in the state of Minnesota saves the taxpayers about $750 million per year. Excuse me. And so we would ask your support in including non-career firefighters, survivor families, into this benefit package that's currently available for career firefighters. And again, it's just their families in the event that the firefighter dies in the line of duty.
Hey, thank you, sir. Go ahead with your name and organization and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jay Wood. I'm the fire chief for Plato, Minnesota. It is a department within Representative Grunhagen's legislative district. I want to thank Representative Grunhagen, Representative Cornish, and other members for their support of this bill. This is an important piece of legislation for the non-career firefighters. Conceivably, there could be a fire where a line-of-duty death could occur for both a career and a non-career firefighter. And this bill will help to level out the playing field for benefits for both of those in the unforeseen circumstance that someone was killed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Representative Hackbarth, you have another testifier or two?
Yes, if the committee would indulge us one few more moments, we have a couple more folks I would like to.
You bet. Anybody that would like to start with your name and organization and begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bill Mund. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs and the fire chief in the city of St. Cloud. To carry on a little bit with Chief Wood's point, the city of St. Cloud routinely, at least on a monthly basis, operates with mutual aid companies coming in from our surrounding cities that are all non-career. Most recently at a major fire of a Roosevelt school in St. Cloud, I had seven area departments in with over 75 of their personnel side by side with my personnel. Should a tragedy struck, the possibility of one or more firefighters being killed in line of duty wasn't just a possible, it could have happened. And very likely a full-time and a non-career firefighter could have both lost their lives. And how do I, as a fire chief, tell those two families, well, you're going to get health coverage until your spouse would have been 65, and sorry for you, but thanks for your help. We believe, as the state fire chiefs, it's an equity. It's an inequity that needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir, with your name and title?
Chairman Cormish, I'm Mark Rosenblum. I'm with the Golden Valley Fire Department. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. And just to carry on a little bit more what Chief Munn said, In the situations that we've been describing, we've already made legislature aware that we have a problem with recruiting and retaining firefighters. There's other bills that are out there. This is just one more piece of the puzzle. How can we recruit and retain firefighters when we've got discrepancies in the benefits between them choosing a paid-on-call department, staying close by to their rural area, and considering something that's more formal, like a paid position where they have lots of benefits. So I just wanted to let you know that this inequity is something that the State Fire Department Association is very much aware of, and we are asking for your support on this. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Sir, your name and organization, and begin.
Kevin Schroeder. I'm the fire chief with the Coke Area Fire District in Northeast Minnesota. And my organization is a combination organization. We run two-thirds of my staff is volunteer, one-third is full-time. So I have both classifications employees riding on the same vehicles. And one I am statutorily mandated to cover, and one I am prohibited from covering. So in my own department, when I have multiple people on one vehicle, some I'm allowed to cover and some I'm not. So again, to back up the inequity part of it, all firefighters should be treated the same and covered the same.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Representative Considine, question.
I know we're not going on long about how much we love this bill, but I do. Mankato, where I was the city councilman for 16 years, has a hybrid program. So, again, they would have firefighters of both designations going to a fire and yeah, I find it appalling that one would be covered and one wouldn't. So strongly support this. My only question is piggyback on Representative Grunhagen, is why we aren't putting some money towards it so it's not an unfunded mandate. It's something that's important, I think, deserves some funding, too. Thank you.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House File 1354 and House File 1286 are pretty much, I believe, the same bill. One just requires the reporting, and one does not. So what is our plan for these two bills?
Representative Hilstrom, we're going to lay Representative Grunhagen's bill over and forward Representative Hackbar 1354 to GovOps.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, I just have a couple small questions. One would be, do you know what the number of firefighter deaths we have per year or for 5 years?
Go ahead, sir, with your name and title again.
George Espenson, Eden Prairie Fire Department and the State Chiefs Association. Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the average is about one every other year. So in the, since 2003, there have been five line-of-duty deaths for fire in the fire service.
Mr.
Representative
Chair, I wanted that information out because I've unfortunately had a line-of-duty death in one of my departments a few years ago. And it's very devastating to these departments, and not only to the departments, but especially to the families. And it's a real struggle for the departments to deal with it. I really like this bill. It's something that we do need to do. But because we have a number of fire departments that are fire districts and not associated with any municipalities, we have a number of fire departments that are just township, do not have a city or any agency in their entire fire area that is actually a municipality that has insurance for the, or even has any employees. I'm just wondering if we should look at possibly, because the number of people this involves with the number of deaths, we should maybe look at having the dependents, instead of having the local government take care of it, and but then who would take care of it? There is no local government to have this these families put on the state plan and have the state pay for it. I don't think it'd be much cost, but I think in the long run we'd be better off because we have some departments that would not have a local agency to turn back on to get the insurance.
Hey, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hackbarth, for bringing this forward. I have two questions. One is just relating to the issue of dependency. Would that include somebody who was a dependent of a firefighter who would remarry before age 65?
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus, our language doesn't seek to do anything except for include non-career firefighters into the current program. I don't know all the details of the current program other than to say that it's designed to defray costs for local jurisdictions until that firefighter would have reached the age 65. I can't speak to the dependent or the marrying and all those other subsequent things. I'm sorry.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you. And I wanted to track on what Representative Johnson was talking about. Besides fire districts, quite a few communities operate in cooperation with each other under a joint powers agreement. And there aren't very many of these that exist, but when I was a mayor in West Hennepin County, we have the Loretto Fire Department, who sent me a letter, who's very supportive of this, is being remiss in this is one of the few circumstances that they are operating as a nonprofit corporation. So they are the operator, and the cities around contract with them. And so, like Representative Johnson pointed out, the municipalities in this circumstance, when you have a joint powers agreement, they're not operating the fire department. The fire department is a nonprofit, and and doesn't have the benefit of access to those municipalities around that they serve to their health plans. What they do is they apportion their budget based on a combination of fire calls and also based upon the tax capacity of the area that they serve. And so many of the communities in West Hennepin have overlapping fire service, and in the case of the community that I was mayor of, we had the city of Hanover providing service, we had the city or the Loretto or the Loretto nonprofit providing service, and then we also had the Rockford Fire Department. So this would be something that kind of gets them left out. And when we did the sales tax exemption last year or last biennium, they got left out also. And so it's a rare circumstance, but I hope that we could pick them up.
Okay, any other questions, members? We have a somebody to testify from the league. You could state your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Kushner. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. My title is HR Director. I'm here to testify, unfortunately, in opposition to this bill.
Bring the microphone over a little bit. There we go.
Not because we don't support firefighters and are completely grateful for the service that they provide to Minnesota cities, but because of two issues. One is the bill, if it passes, definitely needs some more clarity in order for our cities to be able to administer it. As it's written right now, it refers back to paying the contribution level that you would for a full-time firefighter. As Representative Johnson and others have noted, many of our cities have no full-time firefighters, so they wouldn't know what to pay under this. They may not even have group health insurance. In many of our smaller cities, they have paid on-call firefighters, but they have no group health insurance. So my job at the League is to answer questions, and I've answered a lot of questions on Statute 299A, and this will just create more. That's one of our issues. The bigger issue is the funding. While it has been pointed out that this only happens once every other year, the way the fund is currently organized, the more incidents that occur, the less every city gets. So it's apportioned out. So none of our cities are getting anywhere near 100%. In many cases, they're not even getting 50% of the cost of this paid by the state. So we really would like to see if this bill passes. Yes, we think it's a great benefit for our firefighters. It's an equity thing, but we would like to see the funding there as well.
Okay, members, we have these are good questions to be answered in the GovOps committee, because we don't have any amendments and we're not going to accept any today to fix it or to rectify that. So having said that, can we just let those questions go to the GovOps committee instead of us? Okay. No more questions. Any more testifying from the public? If not, Representative Grunhagen or Hackbarth, do you have any closing statements? Seeing none, Representative Hilstrom, renew her motion for House File 1354 be recommended to pass and move to GovOps. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
You bet. Representative Quam with House File 1232. I can bring my glasses to me.
Nothing but money.
Representative Quam, you may move your bill. I believe you understand it's going to civil law.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I move House File 1232 to pass and be referred as amended to the Committee on Civil Law.
Okay, Representative Quam, do you have an amendment?
Yes, there is. Mr. Chair, that would be the other bill, so I would change my motion to delete the word as amended, or words as amended, and just to re-refer to the Civil Law Committee.
Okay, Representative Quam, you've moved your bill, and you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And basically, this bill is updating and improving and a lot of technical changes and making consistency for terminology and references to a very important statute. And I'd prefer to devote the time to the testifiers.
Okay, Representative Quam, ma'am, we've seen your face here before. Welcome back, and you begin with your name and title, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Law and Policy Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I'm joined today by Stephanie Holt from Mission 21, which is located in Rochester in Representative Quam's area. And she's just here to answer any questions you might have about the experience of serving victims of sexual exploitation and trafficking. MnCASA represents over 60 sexual assault advocacy programs throughout the state. Many of them do work with victims of sexual exploitation and trafficking of both young people and adults. We really wish to thank Representative Quam for his interest in this issue, and we'd like to acknowledge the other committee members who have signed on to this bill, Representatives Zerwas, Hellstrom, Lohmer, O'Neill, Ward, and Winkler. Thank you very much for your support. We're very pleased to have so many partners in the legislature on this issue. In recent years, this body has enacted several important legislative reforms, most recently the Safe Harbor Law, which provides protections for sexually exploited youth. With all of this work that our legislature has done, Minnesota has actually become quite a model in the country for good work in this area. So we hope to continue working with you. I'm going to briefly outline the bill before you, and there are some other testifiers that can provide additional background. And one thing I would like to emphasize is this bill has been vetted by the Statewide Human Trafficking Task Force, which is a large group that has a policy committee. And this includes members from all different professional areas, and so we hope we've come together with a bill that reflects lots of different opinions of best practices. One thing I do have, if the chair will allow, is a statement from the Trafficking Task Force that supports this and just a brief summary of the reforms in our bill. If I can provide them to a page.
Okay, you bet.
Okay, to the bill, just briefly, it creates limits on the release of law enforcement data to protect the identity of sex trafficking victims. Already in our statutes, we have that protection for victims of sexual assault. Seems to make sense to expand this to victims of sex trafficking as well. It updates predatory offender registration requirements. Prohibits the requirement of a polygraph test as a condition of reporting a crime, which already exists in statute for victims of sexual assault. It adds sex trafficking to a list of violent crimes, which recognizes what we believe is the seriousness of the crime, and also allows for post-conviction HIV testing if a victim wants to seek it. Again, this is also something that's currently allowed in statute for victims of criminal sexual conduct. It updates the statutes addressing attempts to hire a minor for prostitution, and this is where our testifiers from the law enforcement perspective can provide some more information. It allows as an affirmative defense in a charge of prostitution evidence of being a labor or sex trafficking victim. It extends existing restrictions of ownership of an adult business to exclude individuals convicted of sex trafficking, and extends the existing statute of limitations for prosecuting trafficking and sexual assaults. And what you'll see right now in the statute is we do have a longer statute of limitations in criminal sexual conduct when the victim is a minor, and so this would add sex trafficking to that list as well. So I'm happy to answer any questions about the bill. I want to reiterate how pleased we are to have Representative Quam as a partner in this work, and thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Another testifier? Go ahead, begin with your name and organization.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Sergeant Grant Snyder. I'm a detective with Minneapolis Police Department. I've been the lead investigator for Minneapolis on our juvenile trafficking team for the past approximately 4 years, and I've had approximately 15 years of working with cases involving human trafficking. The testimony I'd like to provide here focuses on two particular areas, and the first one has to do with the language in this bill, which speaks to the use of undercover police operations as a means to detect and investigate John activity, or what we would call, what would more appropriately be called patron activity under 609.324. Back about a year and a half ago, we, in following with some other jurisdictions around the country, had tried to initiate a demand suppression detail. And of course, sex trafficking is a demand-driven enterprise. The most important and salient efforts that we can provide to really change the whole landscape of how sex trafficking is handled in our jurisdiction here in the state of Minnesota is to really find appropriate and effective ways to target demand. In this particular case, I ran a test ad on Backpage.com, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. It took approximately 7 minutes before the ad came down, and during that 7 minutes, I received 97 responses, and I requested text responses. So 7 minutes, 97 men that had responded and said, I'd like to come and see you. This started off a process where I picked four of the responses because this was a test process, and I communicated with them via email for a period of approximately 2 weeks. During that two-week period of time, I identified myself as a 16-year-old girl who had a 17-year-old friend, and this communication continued. Approximately after this disclosure was made that they were 16, about half of the guys fell off. So now I'm talking about two people that I'm dealing with at this point. Over the course of the next couple of weeks, we managed to set up dates for both of these men. One didn't show and one did show. And this man that ended up coming down to a Bloomington hotel room was arrested upon arriving because that was his act in furtherance of the crime. This man came from a northern city. I don't want to disclose which one. And he had some level of prominence in the community. This gentleman, at the time that we arrested him, had an entry card for another hotel in his pocket. Brought him back to our city hall, and we interviewed him. And at that time, this gentleman disclosed why he was there. Of course, we had all the texts and email exchanges that made it very clear. When we presented that case for charging, now let me get back to the hotel room in a second, but we presented that case for charging, again, as a test case, we were informed that because of the way that the language was in the statute and the interpretation on the crim jig, the expectation was that 16-year-old, that person representing himself as 16 years old was in fact 16 years old. There wasn't over the age of 18. Obviously, I'm 52 years old. I don't fit that bill. The issue here for us is one of being able to target these men. We found out that we could use 609-352, which is an online solicitation, but the victim has to be 15 years of age or under. That leaves a real gap for us in being able to target those men who are willing to hire a 16 or 17-year-old girl. And in fact, the 609-352 statute doesn't even get to the trafficking issue. I can tell you after sitting with literally hundreds of these men over the course of my career, these guys are broken. These guys are injured. They're doing activities that we need to target. We need to help them. We need to stop them. This allows me to get in front of them to target this kind of activity and putting in the language about us being able to conduct undercover operations and that not being an affirmative defense opens up, puts you know, new wheels on the trike and opens up a whole area of opportunities for us to be able to target this. Just so you know, that gentleman that we were not able to charge under this law, that other card, he had set up a room at the Holiday Inn Express in Bloomington with cameras and with play clothes and sex toys and things like that. That was the extent to which this man was willing to go, and to this day that man remains uncharged. That's the gap in this law that I'm interested in trying to fill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Susan Siegel, and I'm the city attorney for the city of Minneapolis. And I chair the city's juvenile sex trafficking work group efforts. And as part of that, in preparing, and thank you, Representative Quam and the authors of this bill, in preparing for this legislative session, I gave a call to Sergeant Snyder, who you just heard from, who is a national leader in doing this kind of law enforcement work, and asked him what he needed. And this was his request. Just sitting out here in the audience, I was talking to Representative Pinto, and he mentioned that the Winona County Attorney's Office just had a case dismissed, very similar. And so we need this whole fixed in the law. This morning, I was drinking coffee at home, finished reading the paper. It was about 7:20 in the morning. And I switched to, looked up Backpage.com under the escort ads for Minneapolis-St. Paul. So already at 7:20 in the morning, this morning, there were 37 ads posted, including code words for young kids, young Latina vixen, young seductive, spelled S-U-D for the record, fresh young Asian. And so I just appreciate all of you paying attention and helping with this law. Stings are effective, and that's a sure way to help shut down this kind of trade. I want people who are clicking on Backpage to know that the person on the other end of the text may well be Sergeant Grant Snyder, not their young vixen, and that they may well wind up doing some prison time as a consequence. So thank you all.
Any other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, no. That would conclude the testifiers, and if there were any questions, we'd be available. And again, thank you for moving it, flipping the two bills so that one of the testifiers would be able to leave to go to a family thing.
And then Representative Kwan, we've got a fiscal note on it, so that if it goes, when it goes to civil law and gets that taken care of, then we bring it back here, I guess. So Representative Hilsman, did you have any? Oh, okay. Any other questions? Representative Kwan, you want to renew your motion?
Most certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Public testimony, I'm sorry. Any public testimony? Okay, Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion that House File 1232 be moved and passed and re-referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Okay, everybody hear the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you, Representative Kwan. And Representative Kwan, you got another bill, House File 31. This is the one that has the amendment.
Correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'd like to move House File 31 to pass and be re-referred to the Government Operations and Elections Committee as amended.
Okay, Representative Kwan, you've moved your bill. Do you have an author's amendment, A1, or do you have a DE?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would wish to move DE1 to get the bill in the best form.
Okay, Representative Kwan moves his DE1 amendment. Representative Hilsman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kwan, can I ask why you're going straight to a working group instead of actually doing the duties?
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hilsman. When I started working on this bill some time ago, the intent was to do something as quickly as possible. Through the work and many meetings, it became evident that there are portions among multiple different entities in government to try and alleviate some of the suffering and hardship for identity theft victims. And the best way to do it appropriately would have those groups come together and sort of break down the silo walls and allow for a more coercive, basically something that is a one-stop website, a place they can go and find out that's easy on the victim. When I met with different people, it became evident no one knew all the different areas that were touched and involved, and that if the people are familiar with their portion, have difficulty with the complexity. Think of a victim who's going through a stressful time, probably isn't sleeping very well, and trying to navigate to the appropriate bodies. So yes, I really had hoped to move forward with something concrete, but it's appropriate to take a little bit of time, do it smarter. And if you notice, the September 1 date is fairly quick for this type of activity. Working with the agency and the department personnel, they have mentioned there wouldn't be a fiscal note, that they would pull it in, because all the people I talk to, their prime motivation is, let's do something better. And the DE is probably the best path, consensus-wise, to do that.
Representative Quammen moves the DE-1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, there was a couple people from DPS to answer questions, if we had any. Here, Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Quam, I don't have any amendments to your amendment, but I don't see anyone from the County Attorneys Association on here, and they actually prosecute these crimes. As someone who has prosecuted identity theft cases, I think that's important, as well as there's a section in statute that requires the court to order restitution for identity theft, $1,000 of restitution. And in many cases, folks don't ask for it. And so if you have someone from, the restitution or other crime victim services types that become part of it, I just think you should add those to your list.
Representative Quam, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hilstrom. This is going to government operations, and if you had verbiage, or I can have someone take your my notes and generate it. Thank you for the assistance in making this a better bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Quam. Any other testifiers? Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Quam, my only question is I'm concerned about your timeline, because from September to February isn't a whole lot of time to really do a good working group and get a report back. And my concern is maybe we should lengthen that time for a report to come back. That is quite fast to establish the group and do due diligence, I believe. So that's my only concern. Otherwise, I applaud your efforts.
Okay, any other members' questions? Did you want to testify? Go ahead and give us your name and organization, and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rayon Magnuson. I'm the Director of the Office of Justice Programs, and with me is Suzanne Alwell. She's the Director of our Crime Victim Justice Unit. And we just have a couple comments. Again, thank you, Representative Quam, for bringing this bill forward.
Your name and title? Go ahead.
My name is Suzanne Elwell. I'm the Director of the Crime Victim Justice Unit in the Office of Justice Programs. And in terms of timeline, I would just comment that the purpose of this bill is to do a needs assessment and really look at the opportunities for victim services and victim assistance and how best we can do that. It isn't to implement necessarily a program. So I think that we can do that planning stage in the time allowed.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you. Any public testimony? Okay, seeing none, any other questions from the members here? Representative Quam, any closing statements?
It's been very nice working on this to see all the dedicated people and the different departments and agencies that really are wanting to make it easier. And frankly, we need to step forward with this, because identity theft is a growing concern. And I think this will allow us to improve and offer at least some better processes for those victims in a time that's very disruptive. And so with that, I would like to renew my motion to move House File, or that House File 31 pass and be referred as amended to the Government Operations and Elections Committee.
Okay, Representative Quam has made his motion. If you understand it, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Quam. Now, Representative Hertaus, 1255, House File Members, this is going to be an informational hearing. I think we met deadline in the Senate, so we can bring it up. Going to probably take quite a bit of time today. Representative Hillstrom, I know as myself, has a lot of questions, and dissect the bill as much as we can, and then salvage parts that we like or in its entirety at sometime in the future. Thank you. Representative Hertaus, you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1255.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, even though if it's this information, we don't have to move it at all. Go ahead, Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just following your lead. I thought maybe you changed your mind.
Sorry about that.
All right. Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair and members, thank you for this opportunity to provide an informational hearing on House File 1255. As we're all aware, impaired driving is a major cause of motor vehicle fatalities and injuries, which costs our society and the criminal justice system millions of dollars each year. National research has shown that the ignition interlock reduces driving while impaired reoffense rates by an average of 67%. And Minnesota does have a law requiring first-time offenders with alcohol concentrations of 0.16 and above to install ignition interlock if they want to drive. So despite that proven effectiveness in improving public safety, only a small portion of impaired drivers are actually having the ignition interlock installed after their arrest. And so House File 1255 aims to basically enforce and to reduce recidivism, and is focusing on two primary areas of improving the current impairment laws, and that is to focus on evidence-based DWI countermeasures, and then also to create a more consistent law and a more efficient process to adjudicate these violations. And with that, I would like to introduce Nancy Johnson, who worked with the DWI task force and helped recommend some of these changes that are being proposed.
Okay, Ms. Johnson, before you begin with your name and title again, during your testimony, if you could give us just bullet point by bullet point in layman's language what you're actually changing from existing law or asking to change to what you would like. And go ahead, ma'am.
We'll try to do that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Johnson, and I'm speaking for the Minnesota DWI Task Force. The DWI Task Force has been in existence for over 35 years and is comprised of over 140 stakeholders, including judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, probation officers, law enforcement, the BCA, DNR, DPS, MAD, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, Minnesota Department of Health, and many more. The DWI Task Force is committed to increasing public safety on our roads, in part by proposing legislation to clarify and improve Minnesota's DWI laws to ensure consistency and fair enforcement. Ultimately, the DWI Task Force goal is to find ways to get people to drive safely and legally on Minnesota roads. Unfortunately, drunk driving continues to be a major cause of traffic fatalities and costs society and the criminal justice system millions of dollars each year. However, stakeholders continue to find ways to combat drunk driving. On that note, the use of ignition interlock has been proven both nationally and in Minnesota to be an effective deterrent to drunk driving. Therefore, we want to thank the legislature for passing the ignition interlock laws in 2010. National research has determined that ignition interlock reduces reoffending by the average of 67%. The graph that's included in your handout demonstrates that since 2011, first-time offenders in Minnesota with high alcohol concentrations that have been required to install ignition interlock to drive are now reoffending at a lower rate than those that are arrested at a lower alcohol concentration that were not required to install ignition interlock. This is extremely encouraging, and it's the first time this happened in Minnesota. However, Minnesota currently has only 8,600 drivers enrolled in ignition interlock, which is a fraction of the approximately 25,000 drivers arrested annually on DWI charges. This low participation rate not only results in higher reoffense rates, but also in more offenders driving illegally without valid driver's license. As a result, the DWI Law Review Committee, which is a working group of the DWI Task Force, has met for over a year to identify the barriers to driving legally, incentives to become legal drivers by using ignition interlock, and establish consistency in the laws. These recommendations from the committee were passed by the DWI task force and documented in this bill. The first sections...
Ma'am, if I could, I'm sorry, you mentioned two different groups. Could you explain who belongs to the working group, how big it is, and do they report then to the overall DWI task force?
Yes, they worked on finding these different legislative... There were prosecutors, law enforcement, DPS that were involved. It was a small group, and then they came back to the task force with their recommendations. And the task force did not do all of the recommendations, but came up with these recommendations to be used.
Who specifically is on the working group? Could you name the members? Not by name, just organization.
DPS. She's on the task force.
You could come down and... Just wanted to nail that part of it.
I wasn't
down.
On the task force, so I couldn't tell you. Or on the working group.
My name is Jody Askerson. I'm with the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety. Mr. Chair, the members of the DWI Law Review Group, which was put together 3 years ago, consists of prosecutors, defense attorney, law enforcement, members of public safety that work with the program, members from Minnesota County's Attorney Association. And I think it was a very small group.
And the chair,
who was the head of the DWI task force, David Bernstein, who's a Hennepin County prosecutor.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll try not to interrupt again there. Go ahead.
Sorry. In this bill, section 1 through 5 of our bill seeks consistency between the administrative penalties and the criminal DWI laws. Currently, the administrative action enhances sanctions for DWI offenders at a 0.16 alcohol concentration, which is twice the legal limit of 0.08. Criminal penalties for high concentration occur at this time at 0.20. which was twice the legal limit prior to Minnesota lowering the limit to 0.08. Lowering the criminal enhancement level to 0.16 would create consistency in the law and keep Minnesota in line with nearly every other state in the nation that has enhancement penalties for high alcohol-related levels. Originally, both the administrative and the criminal were based on a double the legal limit, but when it was dropped to 0.08, it only got... drop down on the administrative line, on the implied consent line, and we feel that it's to have for consistency and for the original intent of that level to be put at 0.16 for both. Next section addresses both the barriers and the incentives to drive legally. License plate impoundment has proven to be another effective tool to combat drunk driving, especially combined with ignition interlock. Currently, when license plates are impounded, offenders are given a 7-day permit to drive legally to get their affairs in order or to get a limited license or to someone to start driving them. However, 7 days is not enough time to enroll in the ignition interlock program, particularly in rural Minnesota. So therefore, our bill proposes increasing the temporary permit period to 14 days. It also increases the permit time to 45 days for those who were tested for blood or urine, because it takes longer for that test to come back, so it gives them time to decide what they're going to do. It also increases the permit, I'm sorry. In addition, our bill proposes expanding impoundment to all DWI offenders, and by allowing law enforcement to invalidate the license plate roadside based on probable cause. With plates removed or invalidated for the first and second time DWIs, it would be very difficult to drive illegally because a vehicle without a license plate is easy to detect. This bill makes no change in how offenders can get their licenses back, but it would reduce the number of people from driving illegally. We hope more will use ignition interlock and have full driving privileges immediately, which is different than if you just wait out the time, then you cannot drive, or if you get back your license but get on limited. If you get on ignition interlock, you get a full license. But it is not required for those under 0.16 to have to get onto the Interlock program. That is still a choice that they have, and they do not have to go on Interlock. So those over a 1-6, in order to get their license back, do have to go on Interlock. So we're not changing any of that. But we feel that license plates are not being pounded statewide as they should be, and sometimes it's because it's harder to get the plates off or someone is not doing it. So this is doing it on probable cause and giving law enforcement another option of besides taking the plate to invalidate the plate with a tape similar to the stuff that is used on your license tab. So if you try to get them off, they kind of fall apart. So this would invalidate it. Section 8 allows, as I talked about, for removing the plate. Section 10 increases the time for offenders to petition for judicial review to challenge the implied consent from 30 days to 45 days. Many offenders are unaware that they can challenge it until they first appear in court, and many of them find that when they first appear in court, they didn't know about it. So we're moving that to 45 days to give that option. Another change in this bill, any offender now that is enrolled in an ignition interlock program would avoid the stigma of the required special series whiskey plates. Right now, if you get onto interlock, you're still given those W plates. On this bill, this would make it so that you would have a regular plate like everyone else. This proposal would also allow for offenders to drive with a valid license when the ignition interlock is installed and avoid the limited license. There are some people right now that if they get on interlock, they still have to have a limited license. And we believe that because they're on interlock and they're being tested, that they should have the full license. It's kind of the carrot thing to get more people on interlock, and we believe that particularly those that have been canceled and have had more problem, we need to get them on interlock. They've been used to driving illegally, and we want them to drive legally. And one of the main reasons to drive legally is because then they're appropriately insured. And if they have a crash, it will help protect them and anyone they hit. And so we want to get as many people as possible driving legally. By using ignition interlock, roads will be safer and more offenders will be driving legally. Simply put, it's a win-win for both the public and the offender. The bill also includes some barriers that are there now that we want to remove to help more people get on interlock. One is a DWI written test. The drivers who want to reinstate their driver's license after a DWI are currently required to take a DWI written test, which the test must be taken at a testing center, which is often difficult for rural Minnesotans to reach. There's a cost involved. Furthermore, this test is duplicate and often superseded by the education provided by the courts. Our bill proposes eliminating the DWI written test to allow offenders to obtain a valid driver's license much easier without duplicating educational efforts in the courts. Second is the reinstatement fee. Minnesota has the second highest reinstatement fee in the nation at $680. It would be the legislator's decision as to whether to lower that amount or to allocate some of those funds towards the ignition interlock program. In the meantime, paying $680 all at once is difficult for many offenders. A select few are now able to pay in two partial payments, and our bill proposes extending that partial payment option to all DWI offenders. This would ease the lump sum financial burden and allow an offender to dedicate some of that money towards the interlock program. Another barrier is the insurance certificate requirement to get onto interlock. An insurance certificate is required to be signed by an authorized representative of an insurance company and is a hassle to obtain. Currently, the insurance certificate is required for those who have previously been convicted of insurance violations and for anyone who wants to enroll in the Ignition Interlock program. Our bill proposes only targeting those with previous insurance violations, but eliminates the requirement for those seeking to enroll in the Ignition Interlock program. All offenders still must have proof of insurance before they can get their license back, so this would not change that piece. And then the last section has to do with tampering with the ignition interlock. We want that to be not to be a payable offense. We believe that someone who tampers with the ignition interlock should have to go in front of the judge and to have that taken care of. In closing, I want to thank you for hearing this bill. The DWI Task Force greatly appreciates your time and consideration. We hope you agree with these recommendations and will decrease illegal driving and increase public safety on our roads by eliminating barriers and increasing incentives to legal driving, as well as create the consistency in Minnesota DWI laws. This bill is supported by the Chiefs of Police Association, County Attorneys, MAD, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, and the Diverse DWI Task Force. We'd also like to thank Representative Heritels for sponsoring this bill. Any questions?
Thank you, ma'am. First question would be, MAD, what's their position on it? Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, what's their position on the bill? Do you know?
They are in favor of this bill.
They're what?
They are in favor of this bill.
Okay. Representative Considine. And then Howe and Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the bill. I think the interlock works. I used to work with offenders. Does the DWI task force ever discuss, though, at some point, say 5, 6, 10 DWIs pulling their license permanently or after somebody gets killed, maybe?
Technically.
Then quit.
I'm sorry. Representative Constantine. Technically, the bill, there are people who've had their licenses, you know, they're cut, those are the ones that are canceled and denied for inimical to public safety. The problem with it, and until there is a license that starts your car, those people, whether they have a license or haven't had a license for years, can still drive. And these are the ones we want to get back onto legal driving because we believe that it's worth, you know, they're going to drive anyway. I'm not sure whether that would be something, you know, the whole push was to get people driving legally or to get away that if you don't have a license, your car won't start.
And, Mr. Chair, I support that. It's just at some point, enough's enough, and I don't believe they should continue to get licenses.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in the past, prior to the passage of the last ignition interlock bill, people were canceled inimical for up to 6 years. They still drive illegally. They still have to take care of their families. They still have to go to court. They have to take care of their probation issues. So when the original bill was looked at 2010, they are mandatorily required to do ignition interlock to get their license back. This is just trying to incentivize ignition interlock to take down some barriers and get people into the program.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's most of this that I do support. One of the questions and concerns I do have with it is so much reliance on the interlock system because I've heard horror stories of people getting, especially in extreme cold weather, that interlock system not working, having to have their cars towed, extreme expenses. I want to make sure that's a reliable system before we have folks forced onto an expensive system that now, and they choose to go on this system, and then it's not reliable, and they still end up with extreme additional expenses to something that they're actually trying very hard to accommodate.
I think Ms. Osterson's going to.
What's your last name again?
With the program.
My name is Jody Asperson with the Office of Traffic Safety.
Go ahead, Ms. Ann.
Mr. Chair, Representative, interlocks continually change. They continually become more sophisticated. There is actually a system that just recently came out that recognizes has facial recognition. There's cameras required in the vehicle. If there is an issue where the person gets canceled because of a failed blow, and they question that or they feel that they were abstinent and not using, they can file administrative review with the department, and the evaluator can look at those pictures to see who was using the vehicle. As far as the devices, the department work with the manufacturers and the vendors if there's issues, and they take that into consideration.
Okay, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the testifiers. Lots of references to limited license, and just skimming through the bill, it seems like that applies broadly. Could you just give me an example? What does that mean, a limited license?
Go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Representative, limited license currently is given to the people that are canceled on Nemecal to public safety. For the first year that they are on, they're issued a limited license that allows them to go to and from work, and if they need for work, and then to their probation and to court. It does not allow for doctor visit, does not allow, unless they are the only person in the household that has dependents, then they can get something to take their children to the doctor and back. And then after that year, once they've completed treatment and aftercare, then they're issued a full restricted license with ignition interlock requirement.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So currently, people who are on ignition interlock, they can be on ignition interlock and get the benefit even if their DWI was not for alcohol, if it was for drugs. So, but it, of course, can't test for drugs. So do the plate impoundment changes and the temporary permit and all of these other changes apply to all types of DWIs, not just these 1-6 DWIs?
Ms. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, as far as I know, that it does it's based on the implied consent. If they are arrested on the implied consent, then that's where the moving from the 7 days to the 14 days would kick in, and the same for the 45 days. Is that what you were addressing, the issue of that?
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you get a DWI, you can do a blood test, a urine test, or a breath test. If the DWI is based on a controlled substance, not just alcohol, you may not get those results until later. My question is, we're starting to find one of the gaps in the law, and there was just a story by the with the State Patrol saying that prescription drugs is an area, there's a gap in DWI law where Minnesota law is maybe missing many offenders. There's also DWIs based on other controlled substances, methamphetamines, other types. Those offenders are using the gap in Minnesota law. They might get on ignition interlock, but it isn't testing for their drug of choice. And so my question is, if your DWI is for a drug other than alcohol, do you get the added benefit of 14 days, 45 days, these other incentives in the bill, even if your DWI is unrelated to alcohol but related to one of these other controlled substances?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, attorney, I would have to ask any
good man.
Nobody might be able to answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they're all included because they're under 169A for implied consent. But we have talked to different probation officers, and I was remiss in when I spoke as to who was on this committee. Also, there was probation officers from the different associations involved in this, too. And one of the discussions were about the people that have DWIs for drugs. And there isn't a machine that tests for that right now. But the probation officers did speak to that and said if they seen that there was a drug implied consent and the person was on ignition interlock, they would also do additional testing in the courts for drugs. So they would step up testing for drugs because they understand that right now there isn't something that can stop that. The other issue is people typically that are using drugs are also drinking. They go back and forth between the two. So it's very possible they may have been stopped for drugs, but they may also be drinking. So this would stop them from driving with alcohol in their breath.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But these folks are going on ignition interlock prior to being convicted in many instances while this is happening so they can keep their license. And so corrections doesn't have the ability to test an offender who hasn't been convicted for drugs, and it wouldn't keep the vehicle from driving. And they would be getting an additional incentive by having a longer time period, by not having whiskey plates on their vehicle. I mean, this bill does present
it lowers the limit, so you're drunk, higher drunk faster, right, at 1-6, but it also gives additional incentives to offenders to get them back on the street, and it doesn't necessarily test for the drugs that they may have been using when they got their DWI.
Ma'am?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's true. Drugs still do represent a much smaller group than the overall impaired driving that use alcohol. And I understand that they don't get to that immediately, but they're still, once they are convicted, they are tested for that. Unfortunately, science hasn't caught up to the drug world, and I'm hoping that eventually that will happen.
Okay, any other questions yet? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hertas, thank you for bringing this bill. I carried a bill in 2009 very similar to this, raised the lowering from 2.0 to 1.6, and it was around the same time that we were trying to implement ignition interlock, and I ran into a lot of resistance against it, and so I want you to know that I support your bill, and we've seen that ignition interlock does work, and you know, it's an interesting time. I didn't expect to have opposition from lowering from 2.0 to 1.6, but it was pretty, pretty fierce. And it's good to see that things have changed. So thank you.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, thank you for bringing up this bill. I know we had something similar to this in the last biennium. So, to get very pointed, how is this bill any different than the DFL members that were in the campaign were attacked on when they voted for this? How is this any different?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Schoen. You don't have to answer that. Maybe Representative Hertas can answer that.
Representative Hertas, you want to answer that question?
Representative Schoen, would you restate that? Because I don't think I was involved.
Okay.
And
well,
I'm probably not able to answer the question for you.
So the entire GOP caucus voted against this bill last year, similar measures, increasing the ability for people to get ignition interlock that we supported in the last biennium. How is this any different than that bill? Because some of our members were attacked for making Minnesota less safe. So tell me, how is this different?
I haven't compared it to what we did last year, and so I cannot answer that.
So in your opinion, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas, this makes Minnesota safer?
Well, I think the recommendations that the task force has worked on and puts it forth is proving to the National Highway Safety Transportation Board that the data is showing that it reduces recidivism, and you know that I've been involved in those areas in helping to reduce recidivism and get people out of the law's snare and mainstream them back into society and try to work on corrective measures in that area. So if I may have voted against that last time, I'll accept that, but I've changed my position on that.
Okay.
Well, Representative Schoen, I haven't changed my position. I still don't like the bill and might not vote for it. So I didn't like it then or now. But in its present form, I'm not saying I wouldn't, but there's some certain things that give me pause. First of all, to a lot of members, reducing limits is going to be a lot of heavy lifting. We had we were one of the last ones in the nation that went down to 0.082, I think. And so even though this isn't the original DWI, and applying the impoundment to all DWIs, you know, and taking more plates away and taking the probable cause is a tough one for the libertarians and the independents. And the fee change, the 30 to 45 days implied consent hearing, I have a problem with that. There's already too many implied consent hearings that are plugging up the court and wasting officers' overtime. They could be out in the street. Getting rid of the whiskey plate gives me some pause. Avoiding the limited license. So I'm not sold on the bill, but I like the idea. The bill in the Senate side is really broad. They broadened out the DWI task force, and they got all sorts of stuff for defense attorneys in there on necessity of defense and this and that, which I don't care for. So getting this to the final reconciliation is going to be a tough one. And if it comes back with us next week or the week after, I guess it met deadline, the Senate is probably going to be heavily amended. I'm not going to say I wouldn't dare suppose to vote for my members or tell them how to vote, but just from my input, I think there's going to be quite a few amendments on it. So,
Ma'am,
go ahead.
Real quickly, this, I think the bill that you were talking about had to do with criminal vehicular homicide or criminal vehicular operation resulting in death and having them interlock. This bill does not address that. This bill just addresses those who are not involved in a crash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, first off, I want to say thank Representative Hertas. I appreciate you taking this because I'm supportive of you in the direction that you're going because I agree with it. I agreed with it before and I agree with it now. But the reality is it got politicized right off the get-go, and that's wrong. And we know that it reduces recidivism, and it does work. And there are other things that I agree with Representative Cornish as well, too, that are problematic. But the reality is you're taking folks that wouldn't normally be allowed to drive, and now they're being allowed to drive no matter the circumstance. And that was what our members were attacked on, and that's not right. And so that, my question is, by letting people get behind the wheel with ignition interlock, which I'm okay with, how has that changed? How has the attitude changed? And that's more rhetorical at this point. Representative Hertas answered that question, and I appreciate it. Appreciate your work on it.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, too, since that time, I've had a number of people that have come to me and really express a lot of displeasure with the profiling of having the whiskey plates on, that they're perennially being pulled over without probable cause, but only because they have that whiskey plate. And, you know, with the interlock system basically precludes that and ensures that, that they're driving safely and unimpaired without having to be pulled over and unnecessarily.
And the flip side of that is that's the whole reason for the whiskey plates. You don't need probable cause to pull them over.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, you
need
for
the random checks because a lot of them are, or some of them are boozing it up and we want to check on them and make sure they're not Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, I just kind of want to partially bolster what you just said was, you know, that was part of the penalty in the past for, and it's not your first DUI that you get license plate forfeiture by any means, either impoundment. But you still do need to have probable cause, so the officer does have to, you know, state that there is some sort of other reason why they're being stopped. And so that neither doesn't make me be against what you're trying to do. I'm just pointing out a fact.
No, and Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, I just not very long ago was participant in a wedding and where some of the people in attendance had whiskey plates and their spouses, you know, were the ones driving and there was no probable cause. But there are certain departments that I'm aware of in my own district that don't follow that probable cause. They just pull you over because you've got whiskey plates on because it's 2 o'clock in the morning. So a lot of law enforcement has the attitude that there's no reason to be on the road at 2 o'clock in the morning unless you're drunk. And that's just the wrong attitude. And from a libertarian position, I'm happy to see the whiskey plate go.
You're not helping out the bill any, really. We should rephrase it. You don't need probable cause to pull a vehicle if you need reasonable suspicion. So you need probable cause to arrest. So we're all kind of using the wrong term. But at any rate, that's one of the moral of the story is if you're at a wedding, don't get into a car with a whiskey plate. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So under current law, those whiskey plates I'm talking about now go on the vehicle you were driving, whether or not you owned it, and then go on the vehicles that are all registered in your name. I believe that this bill would require the ignition interlock to go on one vehicle, not all of the vehicles. And so does it do anything for the penalties if you are driving a vehicle once you're on ignition interlock that doesn't have ignition interlock on it, or does it do anything to indicate that the vehicle has ignition interlock so folks know to look at them?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there currently is a violation for driving a vehicle without ignition interlock if you have that designation. So if the person has ignition interlock and they're driving another vehicle, they would be cited for that. And that is also part of the bill, is to so that it's not on the payable list, so it doesn't go to the payable list. So a person would have to attend, go to court to handle that.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is the penalty for driving a vehicle that's not equipped with an ignition interlock if you get all the benefits in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a misdemeanor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so currently, if you're driving a vehicle that you don't own, that currently gets whiskey plates, and then any vehicle that's registered to you, that would just eliminate all of those additional whiskey plates for anyone, and just there would be no more whiskey plates. Is that the way I'm understanding it? Or you don't get a whiskey plate if you actually go on ignition interlock? Could you tell me how it works?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what the proposal is that if the person opts into the ignition interlock program, they would not be required to get a whiskey plate. If they do not go into the ignition interlock program, then they would have to get the whiskey plate. This is one of the incentives that the task force decided, even though that the DWI plate does help with, you know, it goes on people's plate on the cars, it's an incentive to go into the program because ignition interlock is shown time and time again nationwide that it reduces recidivism by 67%. And it also has shown recently in research that it reduces, even after it's taken off the vehicle, it still reduces recidivism by 37%. So it has significant results while it's on and after it's taken off. It's saving lives. It's reducing recidivism and saving lives.
Representative Yelsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't get me wrong. I'm a supporter of ignition interlock. I'm a supporter of it. I'm not so sure I'm a supporter of the incentives that are in this bill. So tell me if I'm incorrect, but isn't one of the provisions in this bill that if you violate the ignition interlock, that the commissioner can't take away your license anymore, but can only extend the amount of time that you're on the ignition interlock?
Mr. Chair, Representative, mm-hmm. Currently the people that are canceled and inimical are put on ignition interlock, and if there's a fail, they are canceled. They need to re-enroll. They need to get another insurance certificate. They need to get an assessment and provide that assessment to the department. What this does is give a person an opportunity to leave that program. All this is doing is keeping them on the ignition interlock, which is keeping the road safer, monitoring their alcohol use, and they're still required to get an assessment. They're still required to show treatment by the end of their time. So the only change is that we're not making them an illegal driver. We're keeping them a valid driver, keeping the road safe for Minnesota.
Ma'am, how many DWIs did you say were arrests a year? Didn't you give the figure of how many?
25, Mr. Chair, 25,000.
Okay. Would you agree that that's probably just a fraction of the ones that are actually driving DWI?
There's been a lot of studies having to do with one out of 300 times, one out of 1,000 times that you drive drunk, that you get caught. I'm not sure which is correct because it's rather hard to tell how many are that don't get caught. But, yeah, that does show that there is probably a lot of people driving drunk or impaired.
I think there's been a number of studies that say that if a person is caught for DWI, they've probably driven 50 to 100 times like that before they got caught, and we're only catching a fraction of them because we do hold a high standard for reasonable suspicion and probable cause, and we do have squad car camera videos, and not a lot of cases are thrown out because they didn't have probable cause. So I guess it's my contention that DWI is a real problem, and that we're just catching a fraction of them. And so there's certain parts naturally of the bill that I like, but I see a real problem with some of the things. And so when we bring it back up, we'll modify it as hopefully to most of our majority's wishes and refine it and take it from there. Representative Howe and then Representative Considine.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually not going to talk, but I'll let this go here. You know, I know someone that got his first DUI and blew a one, and was had his license revoked. And during that period of time, of course, all the vehicles in his family were registered to him. And his kids, during that period of time, all got pulled over. The officer would walk up, "Oh, you're not him. You might as well tell that person that his license revoked." Never got a ticket, never told them why they were pulled over. They don't have whiskey plates, but yet they were all pulled over. To me, that's a little bit of a harassment. He wasn't driving. How do you stop that scenario? How does that happen? And it wasn't just one law enforcement agency. It was, they're spread out over the state. So I have some struggles here with what we currently do and what the habitual offenders. And we should stop those habitual offenders. But some of those folks that make a mistake and make, but the whole family pays, I struggle with that. And I don't know where that fits in this bill, but I'm not a happy camper when I get reports like that.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I think the interlock system is great, and I am supportive. But like Representative Hillstrom, I struggle with these things. They don't like having a whiskey, the stigma of a whiskey plate. Don't drive drunk. If I'm going to have sympathy, it's going to be with the 20, 30,000 people and families a year that lose somebody to a drunk driver. This is unbelievable in our, you know, in our country and in the state that we lose so many people to drunk driving. And that doesn't include the ones that are maimed and hurt for life. Interlock is good because I believe it does cut its stuff down, but gee, it's too bad about a lot of the rest of that stuff. Don't drive drunk.
Representative Dean and then Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hertas, for bringing this forward. I'm actually a co-author on this bill because I do support reduction of people driving while drinking. With that said, the United States has most liberal laws when it comes to individuals driving when they've consumed alcohol on the planet. We're starting from a point that's not like we're super, super restrictive. We're actually really, really liberal and really, really free on this issue. There's been a few comments about people getting pulled over without probable cause and randomness. The district I represent, people get pulled over all the time for no cause. So I think it's kind of funny that we're talking about some individuals that have been, you know, a DWI conviction, possibly getting pulled over because they have a whiskey plate, whereas I have people in my district that get pulled over every day for no reason other than the fact that they're driving in our district. So I think we can go down a rabbit hole here about the randomness of people getting pulled over without probable cause, and I think it's really just a rabbit hole. There are a lot of, you know, areas throughout the state that we have pockets that people get pulled over all the time. And ultimately, you know, some type of search takes place when they shouldn't have been pulled over in the first place, and the next thing you know, they've got some type of misdemeanor conviction or something like that. So, again, I support the bill. I think there are some things we can do to probably make it a little bit better, but I want to thank you for bringing it forward.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, maybe staff can help with this, but the penalties of tampering, is there any place else in statute that we list prohibiting the courts from placing a penalty on the statewide payables list? I don't know the answer to that.
Who wants to answer that? Ms. Pierce.
Mr. Chair and members, I have seen it in other bills. I'm not sure if any of them have passed yet, but I can look and get back to you.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second thing that I have is one of the things that we're finding with ignition interlock is it's expensive. And there's different folks based on income availability who can qualify for some additional
assistance with the ignition interlock system. Representative Hertas, is there anything in your proposal that actually makes it more accessible to poor folks to have the ability to benefit in the same fashion from ignition interlock?
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I see the biggest benefit in this bill is allowing people to reinstate their license without having to have a lump sum. I think that one of the difficulties we have in our current law is people don't have the money to reinstate their license. They have to pay their rent. They have to pay their mortgage. They maybe have to pay for feeding their family, and they don't want to lose their job, so they have to make a decision on whether I drive after revocation because they don't have the money or that I can get my license reinstated. And I would actually advocate for a more liberal repayment plan than the one currently in the bill, and I'll defer to one of my testifiers here.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is currently an indigent program with the current program where if a person is deemed to be indigent, they pay the manufacturer's vendors can only charge them an amount of $40 per month for calibration and $50 for installation, $50 for removal. So there is a program currently in place for those that are certified by the state.
Mr. Chair.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. So is there enough money in that process to allow anyone who wants to avail themselves of the benefits of this bill to be able to get this so that they don't have to get the whiskey plates and they have the additional time to drive? And
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is no fund, so to speak. What it is that the state has told the manufacturers they can charge no more than $40, and so they have a set list of prices that can only be charged to those that are deemed indigent, and that's at the 140% rate of the poverty level in the country. So the reinstatement fee, because there's so many fees that an offender pays, the reinstatement fee, but there's probation fees, there's court fees, there's fines, and the people that worked on this and the task force that deal with the impaired driver all the time have found that you also have a working poor that can't afford to get on. And so the whole purpose of this is to reduce those barriers, and I understand there's some give and take on that. But the goal is to get licensed, legal drivers. You're going to have more insured drivers. You're going to have safer drivers and less deaths and less recidivism. But that is what we have is the indigent program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Hillstrom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you tell me how much per month does it cost for someone if they're not in the indigent side to be on the ignition interlock?
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now it's anywhere from $75 to $125 a month.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then is there any additional upfront fee for the installation in addition?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's dependent on the vehicle that you have. Some of the new vehicles, like the Prius, that are run on batteries or a dual vehicle, those are more expensive for people, but a normal, regular car, it can run about $100, $150 for installation for just someone that's not in the indigent program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one last question that I have. You decided that in this proposal that 1/6 should be the amount for the aggravating factors instead of 2.0. I understand that 1/6 is just double the current 0.08, but can you tell me, is there any science or statistics based on actual driver safety or number of crashes that show us that 1/6 is the right number and not 1.5 or 1.4 or 1.8? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually there's national research that shows that there are more severe injuries and deaths at 0.15 and above than below. And that's the 0.16 matches the administrative sanction. I also just recently pulled the total fatalities and injuries for 0.16 plus drivers for the last 3 years. And for the last 3 years, we've had 334 people that have been killed or injured at 0.16 or above.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Hill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know how many of those drivers previously had a DWI conviction of that statistic? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't at this moment, but I can certainly get that for the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we could find out if any of those people had previously been on an ignition interlock.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can look into that.
Got a couple of people on here. I'm sorry, but I'm having a real problem crying any tears for the $685. It's these people sit in the bar and guzzle booze, put everybody's life at risk, and can't. And we're going to help them get back a job, and then they can't afford the $685. Most of these people are probably burning up $50 a night in booze, and then we want to pay their or reduce their instatement fee. I'm having a hard time with the connection, all the carnage and deaths and the problem we have, you know, how much they cost the state. And then we want to get them back on the road quicker. And I know the ignition interlock thing, and it. But I'm just having a problem with that fee thing. Go ahead, ma'am, or Representative Hurtado.
Well, Representative Cornish, thanks for the statement. But as you recall in the presentation, those are carrots that are part of the incentive to go on interlock. And I know there's members on the committee here that have lost family members or loved ones due to this issue. There's nothing we can do to stop somebody who is a chronic problem from getting behind the wheel of any vehicle they can find keys to. We know that. Whiskey plates isn't going to stop that behavior either. But of all the things that the task force has been studying, it's that the interlock system is one of the better systems that is preventing those who don't have access to multiple vehicles, maybe only own one car or one vehicle, to prevent that vehicle from operating. And I think it's a step forward. Thank you.
We've got Representative Johnson, Dean, and Ward.
Mr. Chair, I just want a little more clarification on the so-called whiskey plate. It's very difficult to get a whiskey plate on your very first DWI. You have to have enhancements. Whether it's an unfortunate issue with the over a certain alcohol level would be one enhancement. You need a second enhancement in order to get the whiskey plate on your first DWI offense. So if a person has whiskey plates, They're a chronic user. They've already doing this a second, a third, a fourth time. In fact, I've stopped a person. I gave him his 17th DWI that was on his record. And no, he didn't have a license anymore. But he was still driving. The interlock went to help. He didn't have the vehicle. The vehicle wasn't even in his name. He was just driving. So it doesn't stop that. Minor issues I have on this bill is on the first offense for DWI, your license is revoked in 7 days, and at the 14-day mark, you can obtain a limited license, so you can drive to work, go to work, but you have that little bit of responsibility seeing what it's like to be without a license, because you have to have somebody drive you to work, drive you where you need to go. But then you get your limited license after 14 days. And in this bill, there is no consequence. You don't lose your license because you get your when you do get your limited license, your license was never revoked or suspended, so you had no time without losing your license if you go on the interlock. There has to be consequences for these offenses. And the other issue that I have on this bill is on the 5.25 to 5.27. You're taking somebody's license plate away on suspicion, and the test comes back that they were under .08, they weren't even guilty of a crime, yet you're taking their license plates for their vehicles away and forcing them to pay money when they actually did not violate the law.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Dunn, go ahead.
Okay. First of all, on the impoundment of the plate on first offense, if they were below an 08, they would get their plate back for nothing. There would be no charge. It's in the bill. There would be no charge if they found to be under an 08 and they were not arrested. Then they would not have to pay for it. They'd get their plate back for free. The other issue...
Ma'am, I think that the problem was, as Representative Johnson was saying, you took the plate to begin with without knowing that they were over 0.08, and they've relinquished use of their plate and vehicle then until they get the... Isn't that right? I mean, you're talking about taking them up on probable cause.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if that happened, they would be given a permit, so they still can use their vehicle to drive. They would have a permit that would be put on the back of their window, so they would still be able to drive, and they would have sufficient time to get that duplicate plate if it was under 0.08. And it would be based on the PBT that it was at 0.08 or above. And if it did come back below, then they would have the opportunity to get that plate, and they'd have sufficient time to get that plate.
Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, not all SWAT cars have PBTs. Now, and maybe the intoxilizer is not available, so they're doing a blood or urine test. That result doesn't come back immediately. But in here it lists the blood or urine, and they won't have that information for 45 days or longer. And they could have vanity plates on the vehicle, and now they don't get them back. Or the sticker's been put on it that you can't remove. So I just have a little bit of problem with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Go ahead.
They do have a 45-day permit if there's a blood or urine. So there is sufficient time for them to, and they would still have a permit to use that vehicle. So the vehicle would still be used.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Madam. Yes, they'd have a vehicle to use, but if they had the vanity plates or the sticker, and those plates are gone. You're taking something away that should not have been taken away in the first place. Fine, because what we do now, if the way the law is now, if somebody comes back, you do a blood or urine, you send them the form, they have to turn their plates in. If they don't turn them in, and law enforcement runs that vehicle, those plates come back as impounded. You don't need to take the plates right away till the test results are come back.
Okay, Representative Dean, followed by Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And to the testifier, you had mentioned a number of individuals who had been involved with incidences for over 0.16. Mm-hmm. And it was 0.16 and above. Is there any way to sort of dissect that number so we could see what's 0.16 to 0.18, 0.18 to 0.20, and like 0.20 and above? Because, again, it's about the issue related to why 0.16. And to be honest, if two-thirds of them happen between 0.16 and 0.18, maybe we need to go lower. So just if that's a number that you could parse out for us, that would be really helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can certainly look at that and see what our researchers can find.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. We've been talking a long time about how to get the interlock on, but I haven't heard or seen anything. How do people get it off?
Go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Representative, once the offender has completed their required amount of time on the ignition interlock, so if a person is revoked, at 0.16 or above, they're required to have it to drive legally for 1 year. For those second-time offenders, if they're under 0.16 or over 0.16, it's either 1 or 2 years. So for the people that are revoked, they have that required time, and then they have to do the last 90 days, they cannot have any failed blows. And the reason for that is to change behavior, to teach them not to get into a vehicle with alcohol in their breath. Once they've completed that, there's been no failed blows for the last 90 days, then they receive a notice from the department. They go in and they get their vehicle calibrated for the last time. A notice comes from the vendor. The department looks at that, and then they will reinstate that person to full privileges without interlock device. The people that are canceled and inimical have to do the 3, 4, 6 years of abstinence and cannot have any failed blows during that time. Once they've done that, they've submitted their treatment and aftercare and shown that's successful. they're reinstated at the end of the time, and they're sent a notice by the department.
One follow-up.
Representative Ward.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I also wonder, do you have numbers on how, and this is kind of connected to some of the other information that has been asked for, but people who've gone through that whole process, and I'm assuming that there are other services available to help them change their behavior, how often do we end up with people on repeat opportunities for the interlock system?
Mr. Chair, Representative, at this point, I don't have that. Our office is in the middle of an evaluation of the whole interlock program since the pilot in 2007 started. And we'll have results of that, but we can. We know there are some people that may have violated, but overall, most of those, the people that have been in the interlock program are very thankful. Their families are thankful because the person can still go to work, keep their job, pay bills, take care of the children, and the family members know that the person is driving safely and that's not going to hurt anyone. Part of this committee, I know there's the committee that worked on this was keeping in mind the victims. Everyone works very closely with the victims of this this terrible thing that kills and injures people, and that is keeping in mind. And I know a lot of people are against the reinstatement fee being reduced. It's not being reduced. It's just being broken up in half. It's to ensure to get more people on the program to keep save lives and actually to support those victims of it. It's to keep Minnesota roads safe.
Thank you. A couple more people.
Just one last question. There's been a great deal of education effort, particularly through organizations like MAD over the years, and focused especially on young people. We often hear more about it when New Year's comes for big celebration times. But I'm wondering if there is some component of this work that I don't see it, about educating people before they get to the point of getting stopped because they are drinking. There are some really good videos, particularly from other countries, on the consequences of driving, the personal, individual, community consequences of driving impaired. And I'm just wondering if that is a part of this, or is it some other aspect, some other organization, some other legislation that's working on education?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety, that is basically what we do, is educate. We have a program person that they deal exclusively with teenage drivers. My job is impaired driving, so I am always educating anyone that will bear to listen to me on all alcohol issues.
Quick answer, and then one more question, and session is at 12:15.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is shown by the number. My daughter was killed by a drunk driver almost over 30 years ago, and at that time, 50% of all crashes were alcohol-related. It's down to 33%, which means that the education is working. We are, you know, constantly. There are some people we're never going to be able to stop unless we have cars that they don't drive and is driven by somebody else. So there's always education going on. So we hope that there's nothing in this bill that does for education, but anybody who's arrested also has to take education classes.
Okay, Representative Howe and Representative Dean on the discussion of random stops without probable cause and reasonable suspicion. I agree that there's a lot of those complaints out there. There's one of the most common ones you hear. In fact, I can count scores of the time where I stop people. I don't know of any kid that I've ever picked up that went back to his folks and didn't say, pick me up for no reason. Or complaints I had my officers in Lake Crystal. They picked me up for no reason. And how do you defend yourself against that, or how do you prove that isn't true, or what they're saying isn't true? So those stories, I think, have been here since law enforcement began and probably always will. That would be probably the biggest complaint that we get, is pick this up for no reason. But it would be nice if we could get to the bottom of it. Just a couple of quick instances. I remember I went up and stopped a person that had their mother sitting on the end of a log, and it was about theft of Christmas trees. And he turned in a complaint to the county attorney that I had no reason to stop him, that I was rude, and that caused his mother to have a heart attack, but he didn't know I had the video camera on. He ended up writing an apology and saying the whole thing was a lie. Another time I stopped an elderly person in the woods checking their licenses, and we had a great conversation, shook hands, and the next day the guy told everybody down at the bar that I was the rudest CO in the world. So those things come up, and there's really no way to defend yourself. And I agree, though, that they're out there all the time. They pick me up for no reason, but they'll always be there. And so Representative Johnson had a question. Okay. You didn't? Okay. With that, anybody got any closing comments? Representative Hertaus, any closing comments? I think we'll bring your bill back in some form. It's obvious that some people have some problems with it, and they like other portions of it, so it's going to probably be some amending going on and see what we can do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and that's why we have informational hearings and talk about the work that needs to be done, and if it needs to be fixed a little bit or tweaked, that's what we're here for. So thank you for that opportunity, and look forward to having this conversation again.
Okay, thank you very much, and with that, meeting adjourned.